Welcome to the Nutrition Science Podcast, where we help you cut through the noise and make informed, science-based decisions about nutrition and your health. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Nutrition Science Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adrian Chavez, and today we have a Q&A episode. So we are going to be covering five questions on this episode. I am going to try to get through them quickly. For those of you who are familiar with the Q&A episodes, these are questions that have been submitted either through a PayPal link. So I have a PayPal donation link in the show notes. And if you leave a donation of any amount, I will answer that question. So I have a couple of the questions from today or are from that PayPal donation link. And then I have a few other questions that I pulled from my social media, from my Instagram. So I ask questions there, and there's some general themes that I wanted to discuss or some topics that came up that I want to cover from that. So if you are interested in asking a question and you want to make sure that your question gets answered, you can leave a donation to the podcast and answer the question in the notes of that PayPal donation link. So you can donate any amount and I will cover that. Now, if too many questions come in at, you know, people leaving a dollar and a bunch of questions come in, I might have switched it up a little bit because my capacity to answer questions is limited. But right now we're going fine. So if you have a question and you want to make sure that it gets answered, you can do that through that method. Any other way, most likely very low probability that it's going to actually get covered on the show. You can put a question into my Instagram box, but I get hundreds of questions when I post a story with a question box. And so that often doesn't lead to a high probability of your questions getting answered. So today, what we're going to be covering, the first thing that we're going to be covering is what's called a faster way to fat loss program. I really am not familiar with this program. I've heard about it a lot of times, asked about it several times, and that's why I want to cover it because it seems to be very popular. Next thing is going to be macro counting for weight loss. So that's going to kind of tie into the first topic, and I will go into a little bit more detail about what that looks like. Is that useful? Is it important? Does it help? And those of you who have listened to the show probably know my answer to that one already, but I'll go into detail about that and refer you to other episodes that'll help you gain more insight about that particular topic. The third one, is oat milk healthy? This is a question that keeps coming up. I'm not sure why. I think it's because oat milk has become popular and then there's all these influencers demonizing oat milk on social media. For some reason, people keep asking me whether or not oat milk is okay to drink or is it healthy. And the question that came in specifically multiple times, is oat milk healthy or is oat milk okay to drink? So we're going to discuss that. And we are going to also discuss tips for what to do if you don't like vegetables. So if you don't enjoy eating vegetables, you have a hard time eating vegetables, and you hear about the health benefits of vegetables, what can you do? We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about simple ways to reduce salt in your diet. Okay, so let's go ahead and start with the faster way to fat loss program. So the faster way to fat loss program, I don't know what it is. I went onto their site and it's apparently a 6-week program. Let me tell you what their headline was. 6 weeks, it was like lose 15 pounds and gain lean muscle in 6 weeks. Like, you're just not going to do that. And this is red flag, huge, massive red flag number one. Promises that are exaggerated, that are unrealistic, that are unattainable. Your possibility of losing 15 pounds of fat while gaining lean muscle in 6 weeks is almost impossible. This would require being on a very low calorie diet, eating a lot of protein, lifting weights, and just being extremely, extremely dialed into your lifestyle. And you probably, in most cases, for most people, still wouldn't get anywhere near that 15 pounds in 6 weeks and also gaining lean muscle at the same time. This is unreasonable in terms of this promise that they're making. So that's, for me, massive red flag number one. I know it's hard to examine some of the strengths of these claims or how realistic some of these claims are, but understand that fat loss, if you lose a pound a week, that means you have to be in about a 500 calorie deficit. So you have to be eating 500 calories less than what you're burning. And so if you're losing 15 pounds over 6 weeks, that's 2.5 pounds a week. And that means that you're at a 1,250 calorie deficit. And let's say, for example, you are a normal sized woman who's baseline energy needs are about 2,000 calories. In order to be at a 1,250 calorie daily deficit, you'd have to be eating 750 calories. And I don't know what they're prescribing. I'm guessing they're prescribing a very, very low calorie, pretty restrictive diet, but this is unreasonable. So again, red flag number one, when you see these claims, think about this. If someone's telling you that you're going to be losing more than a pound a week, and they have testimonials to back that up, it's very likely that they are putting people on very low calorie diets. That's the way that you lose weight fast. If you're trying to approach faster weight loss, you're going to do so by going on a very low calorie diet for a short period of time in a way that's likely unsustainable. You're going to lose weight and then you're going to put it back on. Who hasn't gone through this process? You're going to lose the weight. You're going to put it back on. How many of you listening have gone through this process over and over and over and over again? So do not recommend. Another thing I saw on here is, you know, they're recommending gluten and dairy-free meal plans. They have an intermittent fasting timer. So apparently they're recommending some type of fasting. And so these things are just unnecessary. But when you put these things in place and you say it's science-based, so you tell people they got to fast and they have to restrict gluten and dairy and they have to avoid seed oils and all these other things, what you end up doing is you limit the food choices to such a degree that it makes it a little bit easier for people to eat less calories because they can't, if you put hard restrictions, you can't eat seed oils when they're going to make a choice and they go to grab something that seems, you know, something that they want to satisfy their hunger with, and they read the back and they see seed oils, they can't eat it. So then that takes the option off the table and that leads to lower calorie consumption. That's how a lot of these things work. Place a lot of restrictions on someone, they're going to eat less calories. Weight loss, fat loss comes down to eating less calories than you burn, making sure that you're eating enough protein so that you don't lose muscle mass, and then doing some type of resistance training as well, again, so that you don't lose muscle mass. And you can go on lower calorie diets for a short period of time, even up to 6 weeks. That's, you know, that's okay. That's not going to harm your health. But doing these things, thinking that this is the new lifestyle that you need to start to follow, is really damaging because you're going to be starving and it's going to have a negative impact on your energy levels, on your mood, on your hormones. And over time, you're not going to be able to stick to it. So you're going to try to stick to this really low calorie diet. You're going to see progress and then you're going to binge and gain weight. And then you're going to do it again and again and again. And when you take a different approach, when you focus on a more sustainable, more moderate approach to fat loss, you can lose the weight. Now it's not going to, in 6 weeks, you're not going to lose 15 pounds. In 6 weeks, you're going to lose 5 pounds. And it's going to feel like you're not making progress. But in 6 weeks, you lose 5 pounds. In 52 weeks, you lose 40 pounds. And 40 pounds over 52 weeks is a lot better than losing 15 pounds and then gaining 15 and then losing 10 and then gaining 10 and then losing 5 and then gaining 5. And then at the end of 52 weeks, at the end of a year, you're in the same spot. This is what most people are doing. So to stop chasing quick weight loss and start focusing on improving our habits, on getting a hold of the things that lead to consistent, sustainable weight loss, which is understanding your energy intake, which takes us into the next question, which is, what do I think about macro counting for weight loss? And what do I think about macro counting? I think macro counting is really silly. So counting and trying to hit a specific number for protein, fat, carbohydrates, and total calories, or just protein, fat, and carbohydrates, like many coaches do, where they have people every single day trying to hit, you know, 150 grams of protein, 75 grams of fats, and 250 grams of carbs. And they have people, you know, trying to construct their diet around hitting those quote unquote macros, because macros stands for macronutrients. Macronutrients is protein, fat, and carbohydrates. When someone puts people on a quote unquote macro plan, they're giving them oftentimes protein, fat, and carbohydrate recommendations that they're supposed to try to stick to. And then you have to try to build your diet around sticking to these protein, fat, and carbohydrate recommendations. I do not recommend that at all. As I mentioned a second ago, fat loss comes down to eating less calories than you burn. So you have to know how many calories you're eating and then eating enough protein so that you don't lose too much muscle mass as you're losing total mass. And so that is protein, you know, another macronutrient. So we need to know calories and protein. How much fat or carbohydrates you eat does not matter when it comes to fat loss. And so if you prefer a low-carb diet, cool. If you prefer a low-fat diet, cool. If you want to eat a little bit of fat and carbohydrates and you want to follow a mixed diet, I think that's probably the best approach for most people. But feeling like you have to hit a specific number for fat and carbohydrates makes sticking to a quote-unquote fat loss diet much more difficult, because you're basically trying to construct your diet to hit numbers. Now, if you just construct your diet to meet your needs of protein, of total calories, and then you work the things that you enjoy into that, that's going to give you a lot more flexibility. It's a lot easier to do that than trying to hit protein, fat, and carb numbers every single day. I do not recommend going that approach. Focus on calories, focus on total protein. And if you want to learn more about energy balance and how that all works, how our bodies lose weight, why it might seem frustrating when you see the scale go up and down on different days and you feel like you're doing all the right things, but you're not seeing progress and all of that fun stuff, I highly recommend checking out my energy balance podcast. It's called Deconstructing Energy Balance. I will post a link in the show notes, and that goes through all of the nuances of weight loss and energy balance that many people struggle with. Because I can explain this and say that if you eat less calories, you will lose body fat over time. But many people will try to put this into practice, and then they realize that they're eating less body fat, but they gained weight over the last week, and they don't know why. And it's frustrating and it's confusing, and it causes them not to believe it because it doesn't seem to be working in their own experience. And the reality is that our bodies just work in very complicated ways. And yes, we will lose body fat if you eat less calories than you burn over a period of time. But in the short term, our body weight will fluctuate and go up and down based on various things. It can be extremely confusing and frustrating if you are expecting the scale to reflect your calorie deficit on a day-to-day basis. So definitely recommend checking that out, that Energy Balance Deconstructed podcast. It is going to give you a lot of insight if you have struggled with weight loss in the past. So next question, is oat milk healthy, or is it okay to drink? This, again, I think this question is coming from the fact that companies are putting out more oat milk products because they figured out they can turn oat into a milk, and consumers want milk alternatives because the wellness influencers scared people away from drinking milk. So people largely were going for milk alternatives. And that's where a lot of this stuff, you know, came from. We have almond milk and cashew milk, and flax milk. Companies have realized that it must be cheap or something, but they can turn oats into a milk and then have oat milk. So it's just one of the different varieties of plant-based milks. And what I've been seeing recently is a lot of influencers getting online and saying oat milk is bad for you because the carbohydrates in it turn into sugar, and it's just going to spike your blood sugar, and doesn't have protein, and it has additives and whatever else they are claiming. These are the same influencers that a couple of years ago were telling people to stop drinking milk overall. Now they're telling people to go back to drinking milk, but raw milk, so that you can increase your risk of getting a serious life-threatening infection for no reason whatsoever. And if you haven't heard about this, raw milk is a trend now in like wellness circles, and there's no health benefit to it, and definitely some risk with drinking unpasteurized milk. So definitely don't recommend it. But the anti-milk messaging over the last 10 years in the wellness community is kind of what drove a lot of these products to be produced. So oat milk is perfectly fine. I don't know why it's being demonized. Oat milk is just like any of the other alternative milk products. You know, it contains a little bit of carbohydrates, contains a little bit of fat, contains almost no protein, maybe 1 or 2 grams in most cases. These aren't a great alternative in most cases unless they contain some protein to a dairy milk, but these are all very similar to one another. Oat, almond, flax, all of these other ones. Now, so again, some of these, there's added protein. Soy is going to be one that's going to have added protein. But when we're looking at oat milk, like there's really no concern with drinking it. It's just oats, filtered water. Typically, they add some calcium into it. Typically, they add some vitamins into it. And then they might use some type of gum to help with the texture. And then also in some cases, they'll use like a little bit of sunflower oil or canola oil. And I forgot, that's another reason why it's being demonized, is influencers are getting up in arms about the fact that it has seed oils in it. And again, if you just started listening to this podcast, there's no reason to be worried about seed oils. This is all made up based on wellness influencering. I don't know how else to describe it, but there's science-based nutrition, which is what you're getting on this podcast. And there's like the wellness influencering. I don't know how else to put it, but this is not something that you need to be worried about. What you should be worried about is who you're taking advice from, because these wellness influencers demonizing these products typically are completely unqualified to be giving any type of nutritional advice whatsoever. So just be very diligent about who you're following and taking advice from, the types of posts that you're watching, if you're scrolling through social media. If something comes across your feed and it says something sensational and dramatic, don't listen to it. Like, don't listen to it. It is not going to be accurate 99% of the time. They are saying something sensational and dramatic to get your attention, to get you to believe whatever it is that they want you to believe, to sell you whatever it is that they're trying to sell you, or get you into this dietary cult that they're trying to promote, whatever the case may be. But just be careful with that. And when it comes to another thing, when people ask the question, you know, is something healthy? Whether or not something is quote unquote healthy, it depends on whether or not it fits within your dietary needs. So, you know, oat milk, it's 90 calories, probably 8-10 grams of carbohydrates, very little protein. Like, it's probably not the best thing for many people in terms of like an additional thing to their diet, but can easily fit within a healthy dietary pattern depending on what else is in it. So, you know, it's not, food isn't healthy or unhealthy. Now, there are nutritious foods that we want to include more of in our diet, but when we look at a food and we're making a choice about it, it's whether or not that food fits within our dietary needs. So that's why it's so important to learn about your dietary needs. And that's why I talk about that so much, is like trying to learn about your own needs, your own calorie and protein needs and micronutrient needs. And then when you make choices about your nutrition, you know, making sure that those choices are in line with your own needs. And that's what's important. So oat milk, healthy. Oat milk's perfectly fine. No reason to worry about it. And whether or not it's healthy is, you know, whether or not it kind of fits within your own dietary needs. So last couple of questions. One is, what if you really struggle with eating vegetables? Like, you just don't like them. They gross you out. You just struggle with them. So I have a two-part answer here. The first one is, you don't necessarily need to eat vegetables. Now, you can have a healthy dietary pattern that doesn't include vegetables. You can largely avoid them and still get all of your micronutrient needs met through other foods. With that being said, I don't recommend that. Vegetables are very nutritious. They contain lots of micronutrients that aren't found in other foods, that aren't necessarily essential for our health, but have shown to have health benefits. They're high in fiber, they're low in calories, they help keep us full, and they can taste pretty good when you cook them correctly. Often when I get this question, the first thing that comes to my mind is, what's the psychological underlying factors that may be at play here? Because as we discuss, and you'll hear this if you listen to the episode that I did with my friend Dr. Taylor Arnold about, you know, feeding kids and child nutrition and picky eating, some of this can be formed during childhood, of your parents forcing you to eat vegetables and them cooking mushy, bland, disgusting vegetables, or giving you like canned mushrooms that are like mushy and kind of slimy and forcing you to eat them. And so now you just really struggle with them. Because when I hear this, I don't like vegetables. Like, that the vegetables are such a wide variety of foods. So vegetables are peppers and cauliflower and squash and cucumber. And I know cucumber and peppers are technically fruits, but we classify them as vegetables from a nutrition standpoint. This isn't from an agricultural standpoint, they're classified as fruits because they have seeds, but from a nutrition standpoint, they're technically classified as vegetables. So like peppers and cucumbers and tomatoes and squash and all of these different vegetables can be cooked in various ways, can be seasoned in various ways, can be added to things and hidden into foods to where you don't even taste them. And there are a variety of ways to get vegetables into your diet that isn't boiling some frozen broccoli and having that bland on your plate. So this is, I encourage anyone who struggles with eating vegetables to really try to learn how to work them into your meals in a way that you don't recognize. And then also work on improving your skills with cooking vegetables in new ways. Most people are going to enjoy vegetables in ways that you would have never known when you start to try them in ways that you've never tried them, because many of us develop associations, negative associations with vegetables from early age because we're served vegetables in ways that are extremely unappealing and oftentimes forced to eat them. And oftentimes we had to work on that underlying mindset. So going back to two episodes ago, when we had my friend Dr. Casey Orvitas on, where we talked about mindset and your mindset around various things. Well, your mindset around vegetables, your mindset around eating vegetables, around the benefits of eating vegetables, around the importance of it, around how you think about them. All of that is important in really digging into the root of why you might not like vegetables. Because again, there's such a variety of vegetables. Like, you can't just not like vegetables, that you're associating vegetables with a negative emotion. And that category of foods, vegetables, is such a wide variety of foods that can be consumed in such a wide variety of ways that there's no possible reality where someone just doesn't like all of them. They don't even taste the same. Like, different vegetables taste completely different from one another. If you weren't told that they were both vegetables, you wouldn't even know. And so for people to make that classification and use that terminology, oftentimes my first thought is there's a psychological factor deeper that where there's a negative association with vegetables that needs to be addressed. And then, as I mentioned, the skill of cooking vegetables and getting better at that. Now, people ask about greens powder sometimes. I mean, you can do that. You can use a greens powder if you wanted to. Like, I think it's called Amazing Grass, has like a pretty decent price, like greens powder, that's very similar to some of the higher priced options, but it's not really going to give you what you would be getting from vegetables. So I would just recommend trying to build a nutritious diet around other foods and trying to eventually build up some type of taste for vegetables, because you will over time. I didn't eat any vegetables, none, growing up. I can't think of anything that I ate growing up. I did not like vegetables. As an adult, I learned to like them. I enjoy them now. I like truly actually enjoy them. And you'll see this with a lot of people who start to eat healthier over time. You start to develop a taste for these things. Like, how many people like coffee the first time you tasted it? But I'm sure many of you listening really enjoy coffee. Same thing with a lot of alcohol. So there's a lot of people who drink beer on a regular basis that really enjoy it. No one really likes that the first time you taste it. Same thing with other types of alcohol too. There's many people who enjoy things. We've learned and developed a taste for them because we've created positive associations with those things. And it's just a matter of helping to build that with vegetables as well, by continued exposure, in various ways, incorporating them into really delicious dishes. Like, just cut up little tiny pieces of broccoli and put that into macaroni and cheese, for example. Like, very easy way. Shave off some broccoli from the top of them. You can shave off some of the floret of the broccoli into the macaroni and cheese and kind of mix it in and eat it that way. You get a little bit. That's a little bit of exposure. So we talked about this a little bit more in the last episode, the child nutrition episode, and a lot of this applies to adults too. So I highly recommend checking that out. The next one is tips for reducing salt intake. So my biggest tip would be to track everything you eat into an app for, you know, a week or so. And that's going to show you where your primary sources of sodium are coming from. And for many people, it's going to be unexpected things. Like, for me, I was getting quite a bit from protein powder. So Legion protein powder, there's one of the Legion protein powder flavors that I was drinking. I forgot which one, had 500 milligrams and I was doing a scoop and a half of that. So I was getting 750 milligrams from that. So that was an eye-opener that I needed to make some adjustments to. Cottage cheese is pretty high in sodium. That was another eye-opener for me. So tracking your food intake. Talked about this quite a bit. I'm not one that recommends tracking your calorie intake forever and being obsessive about it. but learning about your dietary habits is really helpful. And the best way to do that, or one of the best ways to do that, is to just track it and look and see, okay, I'm eating this much B12, I'm eating this much vitamin C. And it's not meant to, you know, your track isn't to, when you track, you eat as little calories as possible, and the goal is to stay below a calorie goal every single day. Tracking is an informational tool. So when you track, you learn about what you're eating. You can make adjustments to what you're eating in order to meet your needs. If you're not eating enough fiber, you'll see that. If you're not eating enough calcium, you'll see that. If you're not eating enough protein, you'll see that. You can make adjustments to those things so that you are meeting your needs. And that is what's important when it comes to tracking, not tracking to stay under 1200 calories every day. So I can't recommend that enough. And another thing that was mentioned in the question, food tastes bland if it doesn't have a lot of salt on it. And that's just a taste bud thing. We can actually reduce or increase our sensitivity to salt by how much we eat. So if you're eating a lot of salt and you're used to eating a lot of salt, you're going to have less of a sensitivity to it, and you're going to need more. And so that might require just eating bland food for a while. And that's okay. Every meal doesn't have to be extremely satisfying and light up our taste buds. It may require you just to go really low salt for a period of time. And same thing with sugar for some people. If you're used to having lots of sugar on a regular basis, your taste buds are going to become less sensitive to very sweet foods, and you're going to need more of those sweet foods in order to get that same level of satisfaction. And this is something that I've seen in with my son. So I've never really, you know, sweet foods have not been something that have been a normal part of his daily diet. And no, that doesn't mean I restrict him at all. Ice cream multiple nights a week, candy that is available that he can have pieces of when he wants to. It's just not something that we do a lot of. And when we do it in moderation. We have small amounts. I'm not just opening up a tub of ice cream and we're eating the whole thing. It's just, he's just not used to that. Hasn't been raised in that. And when he's around, like when we go to birthday parties and things like that, and there's very sweet foods around now, and I talked about this in the last episode previously, I used to not let him have anything sweet like that. Like it just wasn't available, and he would go crazy every time we were at these types of events, and he would eat everything in sight. This was like 4 years old. Now I've become more relaxed about a lot of those things because I saw those types of behaviors. And I've let him just have more access to, as I mentioned, candy, ice cream, like those things are available. He asked me, but he can pretty much, like, I'm not going to say no. In most cases, he knows that if he wants to have some ice cream after dinner, he can have a little bit of ice cream after dinner. Now, if he sits down and eats the whole tub, I'm going to say something about that. We're going to talk about regulation of how much you eat and how much you need and all of that. And he never does that. He has a couple of bites and puts it away. But the point that I was making is when we go to like a birthday party or anything now and there's sweets out and he gets cake, he'll have just a small amount. And very often he'll tell me that it's just too sweet. I can't eat this. It's too sweet. And he'll say this in other environments. He's said this to me multiple times of like not wanting to eat something because it's too sweet. And I'm pretty confident, I can't say this for sure, but I'm pretty confident that's just due to a lack of a high exposure to sweetened things. And one of the things that can really, in my opinion, have a negative effect is if your kids or even adults are consistently drinking sweetened beverages. Because if you're consistently drinking sweetened beverages, your taste buds are going to become very, very acclimated to having that sweet perception on a regular basis. And I've seen this with kids who are regularly drinking like juices and Capri Suns and those type of things, that they just have a hard time drinking water. And again, your taste buds can just become a little bit desensitized to the sweet, to the salty. And if you do that a lot, you may need to go through a quote unquote detox where you really reduce that amount for a period of time to where things don't taste good to you, so that you can start to develop that sensitivity back, so that you can enjoy the taste of food that is not oversalted. Another thing that you can do is just salt the food at the end instead of like throughout the cooking process, so that you taste it and that salty taste is more pronounced to you. But that may require, and that was a really long story to talk about, you know, it may just require reducing your salt intake quite a bit for a period of time and just dealing with the fact that the food doesn't taste as good for you right now. But once you adapt, it's going to taste better. All right. So that is all I have for this Q&A episode. This went a little longer than I wanted it to go, but let's do a quick recap. First one, faster way to fat loss program. Don't recommend. When you stop chasing quick weight loss, it's never going to be sustainable weight loss. Number two, macro counting. We don't want to count macros. We want to focus on calories and protein. Number three, is oat milk healthy or is it something that's dangerous? It's perfectly fine. If you want to consume it on a regular basis and it fits within your dietary needs, great. If not, no worries, but it's not something you need to be worried about. Number four, what to do if you have trouble eating vegetables. First thing I mentioned was build a nutritious dietary plan that doesn't include vegetables. And the second thing I mentioned is try to include more vegetables by making them more tasty. And then also work on any negative associations that you're having mentally with vegetables that may be causing you to, quote unquote, not like them. And the last one, tips for reducing salt intake. Track your food intake for a short period of time and see where the primary sources of sodium are coming from, and then reduce those. And then also, if the primary source of sodium is you putting a whole bunch of salt onto your food because you need food to have a bunch of salt, otherwise it tastes bland to you, then you may need to just go into a really low salt diet for a period of time in order to increase your taste bud sensitivity to salt so that food doesn't taste bland when it's not oversalted. So that's all I have for this episode of the Nutrition Science Podcast. If you enjoy this episode and you enjoy the show overall, do us a big favor and go over to wherever you listen to this podcast, whether it be Apple or Spotify or anywhere else, and leave a review. This is how you help new people discover the podcast, and this is how the podcast grows. So if you can do that, that would be greatly appreciated. I hope you all have a great week, and we'll talk soon.